The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time for us to check in with Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com, for our look at the week in politics. And Jim, you have brought with you someone out of the cold, haven't you?
Yes, I brought in a special guest for our segment this week, Nicole Crane, who is the Senior Vice President at the Iowa Association of Business and Industry. And she is a caucus attender, she and her husband both.
Kind of a reaction of what it was like. And Nicole, good to have you on the program. It's good to talk with you.
It has been a very brutal start to the year here in Iowa. It felt about -5 with lots of layers, which that was the advice, get in layers, right? So I don't know the actual temperature. It's one that I wasn't going to be out sledding for very long.
There you go. It was cold right away, like within a half hour. The networks were all over this. The voting maybe was still taking place, and eventually Donald Trump took a victory lap after winning the caucuses. Let's hear from him.
And I really think this is time now for everybody, our country, to come together. We want to come together. Whether it's Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative, it would be so nice if we could come together and straighten out the world.
There you go. And he really dominated. Could you sense that in going to the caucus that you went to, that people were saying Trump's name a lot? Or what did you get a sense of?
We had a pretty quiet caucus, but we got a sense of is Trump had a good ground game. There was a precinct captain there for Trump, had a hat on that said Trump precinct captain, lots of folks. But, you know, all the candidates really had someone to speak for them. Liz Cheney even had someone to speak for her, and she's not on the ballot.
No.
There was even a write-in for RFK Jr. So, you know, it wasn't real clear as far as being, it wasn't a raucous, rowdy group. Very controlled, good group together. We have a little bit of an older neighborhood, I would say, from the age. So the average caucus attendee was 65 or 70.
And briefly describe what happens, because the media does a lot of talking about, oh, they're in that room, but, you know, they're really not in there.
Well, you go in, you show your ID, because we now have voter registration, voter identification in Iowa. You go in, you get a ballot that's blank. It's just a piece of paper. You sit down, you talk to your neighbors until everyone gets in, and then about 5 after 7, there's someone that has been volunteered to be the captain. They talk about what happens. Then you vote for the actual person that's going to run the caucus. And then all the candidates or candidates, kind of their surrogates. There was someone there from Florida. Obviously, she wasn't voting in the caucus. Came in and they gave speeches, 4 minutes. And then you vote. And then, of course, they pass the hat around. They want some money. And then they elect delegates. And they set the platform.
And that's it. You're done. And they tally up the numbers and pass them along somehow. And we're watching TV, and they announce this throughout the evening. Jim Ellis, over to you. Give us your thoughts. I didn't get a chance to ask you what you thought of Monday night. Did it go as you expected?
I thought that Trump did what he needed to do. I think it would have been a story had he fallen below 50%. He gets 51%. As the governor of Illinois was saying, well, 49% of people voted against him. This is an all-time record for the state of Iowa for a non-incumbent. No one had ever reached broken 50%. Hillary Clinton got to 50 in 2016, but no one broke 50% until Trump as a non-incumbent. Now, I think that's extremely significant for the Iowa caucuses. Nicole, when we talked earlier, you mentioned that there was kind of a pall maybe that cast through the group when the media declared Trump the winner even before the caucuses began.
We hadn't been, the votes weren't counted. There was an announcement from the individual running it. Oh, look, the media is doing it again. They've already announced it. So I think people were pretty disappointed with that. yes, polls were indicating that Trump was going to win, but I think it sent the message, you know, this is a vote. So there's polls and there's a vote. And so I think a lot of people, a lot of Iowans were disappointed, political folks, non-political folks just didn't like that's what happened. You know, we see that on election night all the time. The AP calls the race, but I think people were disappointed.
I don't recall one recently where they've done it that soon.
It was soon. It was very
they
soon.
They were trying to hold off a little bit until at least polls are closed. But this one was, I mean, people hadn't even voted yet. They were declaring him, not projecting, but declaring him the winner.
Right.
I thought it was very unusual.
It was about 5:31 p.m. Monday night here. Would have been a couple hours later there. So I want to ask you about Vivek Ramaswamy, because he announced that he's dropping out of the race. He said this.
As of this moment, we are going to suspend this presidential campaign. And this is going to have to be, there is no path for me to be the next president absent things that we don't want to see happen in this country.
And then he told his supporters that he had called former President Trump and that he was going to endorse him.
As I've said since the beginning, there are two America First candidates in this race. And earlier tonight, I called Donald Trump to tell him that I congratulated him on his victory. And now going forward, he will have my full endorsement.
All right. Let's first go to you, Nicole. Nicole, were there any Vivek supporters in the room? Or was he kind of a smaller player in all this? Was he represented? Do you feel like he was? I mean, he had actually kind of moved
to
the state.
Speak for him. Person who spoke for him. Very passionate. Had a Vivek hat. I would say, looking back, pretty similar to the Trump campaign on the ground. Didn't garner a lot of votes. 9 in the caucus. The winner actually in our caucus was Nikki Haley by 4. So it's 43 for Haley, 39 for Trump. So close, but yeah, passionate. Also referenced Trump in his comments, saying there are two candidates, mentioned Vivek and then Trump. The Trump surrogates were very kind to Vivek as well. So I thought it was not surprising when the announcement came that he officially, you know, dropped out and then endorsed Trump.
Yeah. Jim Ellis, to you.
The last 2 days, things were going that way.
Jim, your reaction to where Vivek fit in this. Do you think he has aspirations beyond this?
Well, certainly. And I think actually, you know, you have to give him some credit coming from nowhere to do really as well as he did. I mean, here he's, many others, including the former vice president of the United States, dropped out of the race way before he did. But I think now it's a play for some role, I would believe, in the Trump administration. Maybe he's laying the groundwork to attempt to be the running mate. I don't think that happens. A cabinet secretary, maybe commerce secretary. Yeah, that might be in the picture for him, and maybe that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah. Well, as we heard from Nicole in her group, Nikki Haley came out ahead, but it was only one county, as I understand it, where Nikki Haley actually carried it. There had been a lot of, I don't want to say, in the media hype that maybe she was going to be number two. Was that kind of a surprise, or did you expect that that she was going to be number three? Jim?
The polling had indicated pretty well that DeSantis was continuing to come in second place. And, I mean, the media, I think, is trying to create a lot of momentum for Haley. I think she does have some in New Hampshire. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And DeSantis isn't even a factor there. But in Iowa, I think he certainly was. And so I wasn't particularly surprised to see him still come in second place.
Yeah.
And combined, the two of them got 40% of the vote. So it's it now is a three-way race, and we'll see what happens next week in New Hampshire on January 23rd.
Yeah. There were a lot of surveys that were done, kind of exit surveying and getting to know the people of Iowa. The media and Fox News especially did a lot of referencing to what Iowans were telling them, and the significant number of people who really, you know, support Trump don't care about these lawsuits, think that they're political in nature, aren't buying it, are concerned about the border, are concerned about the economy, a lot of the bread and butter issues that you and I had talked about, Jim.
Oh, well, very much so. And I think we'll see that continue to unfold.
Yeah. Nicole, back to you. Had you participated in the caucus before? Is this kind of a tradition in your experience, or was this your first time?
So I participated in the caucus, I don't know. My first one was probably, I remember that in the news today, the Howard Dean verbal screen,
oh, yes,
whatever you want
right.
to call it.
So that would have been probably
I would have been in college at that time.
Yeah. I remember that. They said that ended his run. Anybody who kind of has that kind of scream, but gosh, that would, compared to all what goes on today, that would have been minor. But so you've been doing it for quite a while.
That's probably my first caucus that I recall. So, yeah. You know, in this precinct that I've been in, I've have had three caucuses, maybe four even in this precinct.
Something
I do typically, even in years when there isn't a competitive presidential candidate, I've caucused.
Yeah. A lot of money brought in by the candidates to your state.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of airtime on TV, every other ad? You know, here in California, it's a retail television market when they have a campaign, and every ad is about this or that. What's it like in Iowa? I mean, do these guys literally come up to you and knock on your door? I mean, is it that small?
Yeah. So, Larry, on the TV side, I got to be honest, I have two young kids, so we watch a lot of Wildcraft and Molly of Denali. So I've been fortunate not to see too many of the ads. Obviously, in my role and what I do, I do stay up on those ads. The text messages, the phone calls, the mail, the amount of mail you would not believe. I've got 20 pieces in probably one day.
Oh.
And I've had, we've had three door knockers for DeSantis in the last 2 weeks. When I was sitting in the caucus, I was getting a text last night.
Do the mailers do it for you? Because I've told Jim this story that I was at a local restaurant. It was kind of a little place where people are eating, and a couple of ladies were looking over the mailers, and she goes, "Well, I don't like him because I don't like his hair." I'm like, "What?" I mean, I had to literally bite my tongue that there's some people who are low information, and that little flyer there is all they see, and it's pretty scary.
I don't look at the mailers because we get so many. It's a lot of clutter. It's cutting through the noise. Not where I get my research. I will say I did use a QR code on one of them, and I'm glad I did because our caucus location, it changed.
Oops.
So, which was also, they let the doors open a little bit longer on caucus night because people were going to the wrong place. So I will say the QR code was helpful. It gave accurate information because, again, this is a party event. This is not a state-sanctioned election event.
Right. Jim Ellis, 30 seconds. Obviously, a lot of focus ahead to New Hampshire. What do you expect? You got 30 seconds.
Well, I think it may be fairly close. We've got some new polling out that shows the race actually tied from the American Research Group between Trump and Haley at 40% apiece. But the other interesting part, they ran a companion poll for the Democrats, and it shows Dean Phillips, the congressman from Minnesota, getting 28% of the vote against Biden's 58%. That's been his strongest showing. So we may see a couple of surprises in New Hampshire come on the January 23rd, just how well Phillips may do against Biden, who, remember, is a write-in candidate in New Hampshire because he didn't enter the primary because they didn't go along with the new Democratic
National Committee
schedule.
That's right.
So it could be an interesting night.
Nicole Crane, Vice President of the Iowa Business and Industry Association, thank you so much for being with us. And, of course, Jim Ellis, thank you for your wise counsel. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Economist Stephen Moore is joining us right now, as he does from time to time, to talk about some of the stories in his Committee to Unleash Prosperity hotline. Good to talk with you again. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Larry. Big night for President Trump. He's looking like a winner right now, at least on the Republican side of the aisle.
Indeed. I think a lot of people, you know, get it. The economy, the border. You don't have to go very far to see problems, and it looks as if a lot of people feel like, you know, they kind of want to harken back to how it was when he was in charge.
I think there's a lot of that. You know, when I saw President Trump a month ago or so, right before Christmas, I just told him, I said, you know, Mr. President, your case for being reelected is you just look at the American people and speak right to them and say, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And for a lot of Americans, the answer to that, I think a majority of them, is no, we're not.
Yeah. People on the other side try to spin it like we are and make us feel like, you know, we just don't see it yet. Well, come on. I mean, some of the projects that they're trying to brag about haven't even been built yet, and yet we're supposed to appreciate all of them. But that is a story. We'll see what the next one is coming up, and a lot of people will be watching that. Right now, I want to jump to some of the stories that you've been writing about, and one of the ones that always fascinates me is John Kerry. And he almost looks like a Muppet character up there. I'm sorry, but you know, you watch him, and he's up there. Yeah. Apparently, you've found that he's actually resigned from his role as climate ambassador, and you kind of list off, you know, we all talk about how he flies around the world on these Gulfstream jets, telling us how we're putting out all this stuff, and he's guilty of it, and then he kind of walks away. What's the story here?
Well, he's really accomplished nothing. I mean, it's that simple. You know, he was the climate czar for 3 years. They spent millions of dollars on his office and billions of dollars of subsidies for green energy and other anti-fossil fuel programs. But in 2023, the year just ended, the planet used more fossil fuels than any other time before. The fossil fuel stocks are doing amazingly well, and the green energy companies are going bankrupt. So the market is speaking that the green energy stuff isn't working. And nowhere is that more true, Larry, than what's going on with the electric vehicle EV market, where you saw the big story. I think we talked about this last week, that, you know, Hertz is selling 20,000 of its EVs because nobody wants to rent them. And, you know, that you've got, and by the way, you know, Teslas are fine cars, and I, you know friends who have them who think the world of them, but Americans more and more are turning away from them. And, you know, as we speak, you know, you've got this big snowstorm that hit throughout many states. I live in Maryland.
I saw that.
And in Chicago, the people, you know, a lot of people couldn't get their car charged in the middle of the storm because of the freezing temperatures. That's the kind of things that makes Americans wary of EVs.
I was reading the article, and it shows a picture of all these kind of dead electric vehicles, you know, at the charging station. And apparently, I didn't know this, but the battery has to be the right temperature in order to accept a charge.
Yes.
And so if you've got no power to heat the battery and it's -2 outside, you basically have a brick that you've got to, you know, you have to leave your car. You have to, and people abandon them and lock them up and go away. And what you want in a vehicle, if nothing else, is reliability. You want to know that when you go out there, it's going to start or do whatever it does, and it's going to get you where you are. And it's always been frustrating. I think of if you've ever had an older cell phone with a battery that wears down really fast, you look at that thing, you know, lose its charge, and you say to yourself, am I going to make it to somewhere I can charge again? And the same thing with these cars. The numbers they give you for mileage doesn't add up. They you know, the second you start driving them, the charge goes down, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny you mentioned that, because I think, as you know, Larry, I grew up in suburban Chicago, and we have very cold and long winters. And I remember when I was a kid back in the 1970s, you know, you'd wake up in the morning and you'd have to go, you know, out and see if the car was going to start in the morning because of the cold temperatures, you know. And obviously the technology's improved a lot, and so most cars start up in the cold weather, but not so much electric vehicles. And that can be not just a nuisance, but it can be a threat to people's health and safety as well.
Yeah. All right. You have a story about new bank regulations are going to hurt small businesses and shrink vital lending. Tell us the story about someone you know and have worked with. What's the story?
So this is a story that we all remember what happened, 9 months ago or so, when they had the Silicon Valley Bank and some New Republic. First Republic and others went bankrupt and belly up. And there was a concern about, you know, definitely don't want to see bank runs in this country again, like we saw in the 1930s, and people were a little bit panicked. So the Federal Reserve Bank and the FDIC, which insures deposits in banks, said, well, you know, to make sure that we don't have, you know, a problem with these banks, we're going to increase what's called their capital requirements. That is the amount of money they have to set aside that they can't use for loans. Well, there's two problems with that, Larry. Number one, that wasn't the problem. It's not that the banks that went under were under-collateralized. They had enough collateral. The problem was they made a lot of really bad loans. And so they're addressing the wrong problem there. Second of all, if you tell banks that they have to hold more capital, then that means that they have less money, by definition, to lend. Well, guess what? We want banks to be lending. That's why we have banks, is that's how you expand the economy, by banks making loans, whether it's mortgage loans or small business loans or whatever. And so we believe this will contract the economy. It won't make the banks safer, but it'll have a very negative effect. And by the way, you know, the first people are going to get cut off from the loans are small businesses, and you know, people, you know, with trying to buy a home that may not have the best credit rating. So it's going to hurt the little guy, not the big banks, not the J.P. Morgans and the Wells Fargo of the world.
Mm. All right. A new congressional tax deal. What will we like and don't like? What you liked and didn't like out of it? This is your friend Jason Smith of the House Ways and Means Committee chairman has crafted a bipartisan tax cut deal with Senate Democrats. Tell us this story.
Well, and the background of this story is that, as you know, I worked on the Trump tax cut with Larry Kudlow and others, and that was in 2017, and it worked like a charm. It was very successful at reviving the American economy, and a lot of those tax cuts expire either this year or next year, or most of them by 2026. And so we want to make sure that they don't expire, that they're made permanent. And so there's a bill that Jason Smith, the head of the Tax Writing Committee in the House, would basically make these permanent. And I think it's a good thing. I think we ought to do that. I think it would be, you know, we know the tax policy worked to bring a lot of jobs back to the United States. So absolutely, yes, let's make them permanent and not have a big tax increase in American businesses.
Yeah. There's some, like the Democrats and the Biden administration, that make it seem like giving these tax breaks is somehow a handout to the wealthy, and that we need to transfer it to the poor little students who took out more loans than they wanted. I mean, that's kind of they want to berate you for having your money back, right?
Well, you know, when we did these tax cuts, you know, we wanted to help small businesses. And by the way, some of the small business incentives go away. So absolutely, we should do that. We didn't do the corporate cuts because we love corporate America. We did this because we want factories and plants built here in the United States. We want not overseas. You know, when Trump came into the presidency, our American corporations, you know, versus, say, Chinese or Japanese or Mexican or European companies were facing some of the highest tax rates in the world. And I'll never forget Trump saying, you know, this is like a head start program for every country we're competing with. So we did it to create jobs in America. And as you know, Larry, from the evidence, boy, we brought a lot of capital back. We did create jobs. And I'll never forget Trump saying in a speech, which was so true, that for the first time in 50 years, factories weren't leaving Michigan for Mexico. They were coming from Mexico back to Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of Michigan, former President Trump has been doing really well on the polling there. And I think he's driven home the message back to our first story about the electric vehicles, that they're not going to make them here. If we switch to electric vehicles, they'll be made in China, and we won't have, there won't be an auto industry in Detroit. And Democrats are starting to realize that. And some of them are kind of going to pull the lever for a Republican this time. They may like your policies on paper, but you know, I got to have a job, right?
I think that's right. So this is a great example of where the green agenda conflicts with the blue agenda. And the blue agenda is the blue collar American unionized workers. And those jobs are really being put in jeopardy by this radical green agenda. And it is true, as you just said, that, you know, where do you think the batteries are made in these electric vehicles? By the way, the batteries are the most expensive component of the car.
China.
They're not made in the United States.
There's cobalt or something in there, and the rumor has
lithium and all sorts of metals. Yeah. By the way, that's the other problem. We should be mining for these minerals here. We have, you know, trillions of dollars of mineral wealth in this country, but because of all the mining restrictions, we can't do that. So we, in a lot of ways, we shoot ourselves in the foot economically.
Mm. Well, and then you hear that in other countries, it's, you know, the labor market's not regulated like here. The use of 12-year-old kids doing this with their hands has been rumored to take place. That they don't have the same safety and age requirements for workers in other places.
And by the way, they have much worse environmental regulations too. So moving the jobs and the factories out of the U.S., you know, to China or Japan or, you know, some of these Central American countries, that actually leads to a worse environment, not an improvement.
All right. All right, let's leave it with a funny one. And this one, from time to time, you have them. Biden declares war on highway humor. Tell us this story about how they don't like these fun sayings that are on the signs.
Yeah, I mean, this is funny, but it's also kind of sad that, you know, the Transportation Department under Biden wants to get rid of these signs that you have. These are public service announcements, you know, that hang sometimes over the highway, electronic signs that will say things like, you know, don't speed and others. But they use, you know, funny, you know, little funny aphorisms and stuff. And, you know, one of my favorite one is, you know, don't drink and drive. It tastes terrible. But, you know, they get these messages across and they are humorous and they get your attention. And Biden says, no, that's going to distract drivers. But, you know, the reason you have the public service announcements in the first place is to get people's attention.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I find it so, you know, problematic because, you know, anyone who's done a long cross country drive, you know, it's monotonous.
Of course.
And you know, sometimes you see these billboards. And
here's one. I just want to share it. This is the one that says visiting in-laws. Slow down. Get there late. I mean, that's perfect. It's hilarious. We're out of time. Got 30 seconds. Put in a plug to make you the smartest person in the room. What do you need to do?
By the way, one of my favorite ones was your wife is hot. Get your air conditioner fixed.
Ouch.
I love that one. The Committee to Unleash Prosperity hotline is free, folks. I'm not telling you anything. Just go to committeetounleashprosperity.com and get it for free.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time for us to talk politics with Ann Dunsmore, who has a career of working in politics, guiding politicians, even a fundraiser, has focused her more recent time on a nonprofit. I always like to mention your nonprofit when we do this because it is your passion right now.
It is. Yeah. I think for a long time to come. Angel yep. Force USA. Stop Suicide Silence. Right. Yep. Be the one.
Very important. Yep. We have a lot of people in our military who are having some challenges out there that are really being forgotten. We need to get to them. And
one thing, Larry, I got to say, I went to a conference over the weekend, and it was 30,000 that died by suicide since 9/11 compared to 7,000 in combat. That number is now closer to 150,000 compared to 7,000.
Yeah, the numbers are just staggering any way you look at it. Yeah. All right, let's talk politics. Let's weigh in on some of the things going on in the news. Let's I'll share one with you. This is Dave Minn, who is a state senator, Democrat from Irvine, wants to require the Secretary of State to do a kind of a check to see whether Trump should be on the ballot. Despite the governor not wanting to do this and others in the state saying not a good idea, he has come up with a bill to do just that, to kind of tie this question of insurrection, which to me is a pretty loose connection. I mean, Trump hasn't been charged with insurrection. He hasn't been convicted of insurrection. In fact, the Senate trial they had, the second impeachment, found him not guilty. Yet those on the left seem to think that this is just the right thing to do. Hasn't been panning out so far because Trump's numbers go up every time something like this happens. Your thoughts?
So many thoughts on this. I don't know, you know, if many of the listeners remember or want to remember what happened when we used the proverbial blue dress with Clinton back in the day, the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and we referred to it as the blue dress strategy. Do you do it? Do you not do it? And it absolutely did not work. The other thing, and I think that's what's going to happen here. This is a tactic. When you are in a desperate situation, you take on desperate measures. And you've got two that you're looking at right now. Dave Minn, as he has now been dubbed DUI Dave, and that's not going to go away, has to take extraordinary desperate measures to gain attention and mobilize his base, which he's clearly carving out the liberal left in his race now for Congress, I believe, and making a name for himself for fundraising purposes. And, you know, this is a very big deal that people don't really realize how much money you can raise in a minute online when you do something like this, or when Marjorie Taylor Greene has an explosion on the floor of the House, she raised six, possibly even seven figures as that was going on. And so this is where using issues like this to mobilize the polar left or polar right in some cases is can really backfire.
Yeah.
And it's a salve for the moment, meaning it's a healing element or a fixative, but then it backfires and it becomes a negative. So I think that's what you're going to see on this.
Yeah, Governor Newsom even is politically savvy enough to realize.
Well, he knows why. He knows why, because what's happening at 60,000 feet with Biden is, and I tell all my clients this, what happens in the presidential race is far above anything you can control. And Newsom knows that there's a very good chance that the turnout of Democrats in March is going to be very low because people are scared about Biden. It's beyond worried about it. They're now scared about the ripple effect this is going to have. And Biden just won't let go. Their B strategy and C strategy have disappeared. Newsom brings nothing to the table as being part of the ticket, and they were really grooming him for the eventuality of Biden stepping down, and he's not viable at this point. He doesn't even really bring California to the table for them.
Right, and so Biden's strategy has been just to aim at Trump. Trump, bad man. January 6th. You know, when they did polling in Iowa to see if January 6th is resonating, it ain't. People really don't think much about January 6th. They don't see it as that was going to be that ragtag group of people is really going to take over the government.
Well, the people that aren't responding to it are, there's other things. There's other things that are now making people more nervous. And immigration is at the top of that list.
Huge. The numbers of people coming into this country and the doors swung right open. And it's no longer, you know, you can't pretend it's not happening. And for the Democrats to try to do that, it just makes it look bad because the video evidence is so overwhelming now. And even government stats, they have to report on the numbers of gotaways and stuff, and it's not good. It is not good for anyone.
Well, and this whole thing the other night, even I, you know, I was looking at Rachel Maddow the other night, you know, sanctimoniously looking into the camera saying,
"We're not going to show you the footage."
Along with other networks, chosen not to show Trump's speech, and that's because it's not the same guy. They can't show his speech and then point out his vitriolic nature and isn't this what you want your leadership to look like? He was behaving, he is listening to somebody. And he is doing all the right things.
Right.
And they aren't going to show him doing that.
Yeah, and MSNBC is so in the tank for the left, they won't even show the video. They got dubbed in some articles as being state TV. I mean, that's kind of like the worst thing to be. You're essentially an arm of the government. Broadcasting now. MSNBC wouldn't even air his, here's a bona fide winner. He has the right to the stage and they won't air it. And I get it. That's their format. That's what they're going after.
Well, they're stuck too because they can't sit there and do, he stole that election.
Right.
they can't use those terms. So they're kind of stuck. You're seeing a lot of strategies being upended right now, whether it's the strategic direction of the media, the strategic, you're watching a lot of about faces, your people, meaning they're turning about. And it's really, I've always told you, having a front row seat to this is like taking a PhD in politics.
It is.
You know, it's like, okay, there's changes. And I tell people also, when you're looking at a painting, you really can't understand the painting until you look for the white spaces that aren't full. So it's never what's in your face in politics. It's always what you don't see.
Yeah.
But you could see. It's like right in front of your nose.
Right. Take the Nikki Haley situation. Here, she was lauded as going to come in and just clean up in Iowa and be the number two. She was number three, and now she won't even debate. And now she's moving forward, claims she's going to have it and all this. Trump is still 8 points ahead in South Carolina, but I mean, and then Ron DeSantis didn't even campaign in South Carolina much. He's at 5%. What's going on there? It's like his thing is imploding.
Yeah, well, that's predictable. People saw that coming. He saw that coming. He also had to change his demeanor very, very quickly. And he didn't, I think he waited a little too long. You notice his wife isn't out front anymore. That was a strategy that has gone by the wayside. She wasn't doing him any favors. Nikki, here's what I see. As much as Nikki Haley is campaigning against the president, she is clearly the person that is likely to be his running mate. And I think, you know, if you talk to Democrat strategists, they feel if it's Trump, they have a shot even now with, you know, this guy who's just not there present. And
but Nikki shores it up for Trump to bring in everybody else and the moderates and just closes it over.
That's right. So I would be very careful in the Trump world not to vilify her.
Don't pick on her too much because she might
don't pick on her too much because then when you do select her, it's going to look hypocritical. And frankly, I don't really – she's really proving herself. And I wouldn't discount her small victories at all.
All right. We won't.
Things can change on a dime.
Indeed. Final 30 seconds.
Yes, sir.
What did we not cover this week that needs to be mentioned? You see so many things. Put in a mention for anything out there.
I'm worried about the conflict in the Middle East quite a bit. And I
worried
feel
that it's going
like,
going too long, that kind of thing? Worried that
that it's escalating and it hasn't really been tagged that way.
Okay.
We've now openly engaged Yemen.
And the Houthis, as they say, we're pushing back for their activities.
Yeah.
They've been attacking ships with drones and very bad things, you know, so it does.
Very bad things. And I think that it's something that we is being overshadowed by our politics. And I worry about that. I worry about the extension of budget again. I mean, you're looking at a lot of people who are not making decisions in Washington about very important things. And it's a bad, bad, bad time to be doing that. So there are some things that are being overshadowed and they haven't resolved it. They've extended it again. So, and then there's the little murmuring of getting rid of Mike Johnson. And it's like, oh no, really? We're going to go through that again? It just, with who? I mean, those are the little things in the background that I see that are very, very worrisome. And I think also that the immigration matter is also not resolved. When something is debated for too long, it becomes the norm, and the norm needs to be decision-making, and we're not making decisions in a lot of very important areas.
And hi, Dunsmore, we appreciate your comments and observations, and you certainly bring a lifetime of experience in the world of politics. Thank you so much. Take care now. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Assemblymember Bill Asili, 63rd Assembly District, is joining us to talk about legislation he is pushing in the legislature to try to correct something that he sees is a problem in California. We thank him for joining us. Good to have you on our program again.
Thanks for having me.
This has to do with the recently given benefits, health benefits, to more people who are undocumented, illegal, whatnot, in California. Kind of set this up. What has been happening in the state, and what are you doing?
So as of January 1st of this year, all illegal immigrants in the state of California are now eligible for universal health care. That's going to add approximately 750,000 new individuals to Medi-Cal, which is an already overburdened and strained healthcare system. And it's going to cost the California taxpayer an estimate of $4 billion for the first year. Will likely cost more in future years. And so I believe this is totally unconscionable that the state of California would spend $4 billion when we are facing over a $60 billion deficit. And so on the first day of session, I introduced a bill to revoke all funding for illegal immigrant health care. I do not think it's an appropriate use of our tax dollars.
There is a contingent up there that does seem to want to swing the doors wide open and hand out just about everything. It began with education and now extended to this area. What do you say to those who are saying, oh, you know, you're just wanting to hold on to everything? These people need health care. They'll get sick. You know, they'll make you look like the bad guy.
You know, they come off as very immature and unrealistic. We cannot provide health care for the citizens of the world. We do not have the financial means to do that. And I think they're doing a disservice to the people they were elected to represent. We represent the citizens of the state of California. We have to take care of our own citizens before we start providing aid and health care to the citizens of the world. And until our citizens have affordable, accessible health care, we can't give it to other people. It's just unconscionable.
It's almost as if you're describing it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that some individuals who have come in illegally are going to be receiving better benefits than those who live here already.
Absolutely. You talk to the average person, they are working overtime just to pay their bills, especially with the inflation and cost of living crisis that we're having in California. Their healthcare premiums continue to go up. I talk to people who are paying $2,000 a month just in healthcare premiums to provide for their families. And then you compare that to someone who crosses the border illegally, who's not supposed to be here. They're going to come to the state of California, and they're going to be given free universal healthcare on top of other benefits. That is backwards, upside down, however you want to name it. And more importantly, it's going to create a huge magnet, for more people to illegally immigrate to the state of California. It's a national security issue. It's immoral, and it's unsustainable.
California is only a part of the challenge here, but you're right. If you make something enticing, you say, come on in, and you add that with the porous borders that the federal government, the Biden administration, is failing to enforce, this problem could magnify overnight in big ways, couldn't it?
Absolutely. And the borders are just porous. It's open. The Biden administration has opened up the borders. Anyone who wants to is being allowed to cross. This is the Democrat playbook. They don't give a damn about U.S. citizens. They don't care about us. They want to import these immigrants from other countries in the hopes of getting them to support their political ambitions and their party. That's what this is about. This is an invasion of our nation. And if you ask me, the real insurrection is the one that's happening at the border. That's the insurrection that's occurring in the United States of America right now.
There are some people who try to back away and say, look, demographic trends, fertility rates are such that you almost need to backfill in with a labor force like that. It can be done, but this isn't the way to do it, is it?
No, this is not the way to do it. If we want more people to come, there's no shortage of people that want to come to the United States. We have a lawful immigration process and system. My parents immigrated to the United States lawfully. Most of the immigrants I know came here lawfully. They do not need to open up the border to allow anyone and everyone who wants to come here without being checked, without being vetted. That's not a way to run a country. So yes, if we need more people, if we need more workers, we can issue more visas, we can allow in more lawful immigrants. But that has nothing to do with opening the border and allowing widespread illegal immigration. Two issues have nothing to do with each other.
Some people try to tie them together, saying, well, you just don't like immigrants. You know, they'll try to.
Well, it's not some people. It's the left. It's the Democrats. They tie it together because they cannot intellectually and honestly support their open illegal immigration policy. So what they do is they conflate it with immigration and they call you anti-immigrant if you support strong borders. That's a very common tactic and trick the left does to deflect and to distract from what's really happening. And they're very good at it, and the media is more than happy to help them. But the American people are much more smarter than that. They get it. And I think that is why I believe there'll be a change of administration in this election in November.
Yeah. It's certainly one of the top issues in Iowa recently, as evidenced by the polling that was done on the subject, saying, look, you know, this is a serious problem. And that's even within Iowa. And with people being moved across the country as they come in, this has become an issue not just in Texas, but it's an issue in New York. You've got New York's mayor concerned about it. Chicago, lots of big cities where the influx is taking place and people are being bussed, whether they want to, you know, complain against the governor of Texas. The real problem is the Biden administration and their policies. So you think the bottom line on this is to get more Democrats down the line? Is that what it's about?
You know, I think it's multifolded. I think, yes, that's one of it. They eventually want to have amnesty and naturalize all these new illegal immigrants and hoping that they're going to be dependent on the welfare and benefits the Democrat Party is more than happy to hand out. And the universal health care that California is offering now is just part of that scheme.
Yeah. Whenever you do polling on universal health care, it does poorly. That citizens, at least, aren't for universal health care. They don't want to have a one-size-fits-all government solution to health care. They want to have the private sector or insurance through their work. You know, granted, there are certainly issues with it, but America and Californians, if you put it on the ballot, they're not for it, are they?
No, they're not. People understand that if you have universal health care, everyone's going to have universally poor health care because the system, government-run systems do not run well. They don't run efficiently. And what you're going to have is massive waiting times and waiting lines to see a doctor. It's not sustainable. The free market is the best market and the best method we know of how to distribute resources, services, and goods in an economy and a society. And that's what we need to allow happen.
Yeah.
Universal health care is not the answer.
So I'm curious, though, you're in a state with what they call a super majority of Democrats, and Republicans are super minority. What's going to change? Do Democrats get it that as long as they keep electing these people, this is the viewpoint that the far left has grabbed a hold of it? That's what they're going to get. Are they going to figure out that maybe a few Republicans might be good to have up there enough to force them to have to talk with you folks? Because they don't even have to talk to you, do they, when they operate government up there?
Look, the people need to be given a clear choice in the ballot box in November. And this is where I believe in Ronald Reagan's mantra of bold colors, not pale pastels. And it is the job of the minority party, the Republican Party, to draw contrast and lead with strong policy positions, such as the one that I've introduced in the legislature to refund illegal alien health care. So what we need to do is put out bold positions, be vocal, and fight like hell in Sacramento so people can see us, and then they'd be willing to entrust us with their vote in November. Until people see that and they see value in an alternative party, I suspect things will stay the same.
Is your story getting told in mainstream media? Does your phone ring off the hook from the major networks or not really?
We have gotten a lot of great coverage on this issue because it really resonates with the average person. I mean, we have Democrats, independents, and obviously Republicans have all reached out to our office in overwhelming support of this bill because they understand it is wrong to send our money to citizens of other countries before people in California have affordable and accessible access to healthcare here. So people get it. It resonates. And we've gotten a lot of media traction on this. And more importantly, it's forced the governor and the legislature to have to respond and defend this very poor policy decision, especially in a year with a massive deficit.
So what do they say? What does a Governor Newsom or the Democrats who want to bring this through and have signed it into law, what do they say when they look at it? You know, we've already got this, it was $68 billion. The governor's math makes it $37 billion, and they're infilling with 13 out of the rainy day fund. What do they say when they talk about this issue? How do they justify taking the money and spending it there?
They're mostly delusional. They believe there's enough money to provide this and everything to everyone. So they're talking about raising taxes, implementing a wealth tax. They're talking about the deficit not really being as bad as it is. So they live in delusion. But the thing about budgets and deficits and money is that there's a real reality that's going to hit them. So I think the actual hard numbers will come in May after people pay their taxes in April. And we're going to see how much money the state has, but they're not going to be able to run away from these massive deficits. So we'll see what happens. They're going to have to make some tough decisions, and we'll see how they justify making cuts to California citizens before they making cuts to illegal immigrant health care.
I saw in the governor's revised or proposed budget, he is open to delaying certain things like pay raise to health care workers. Would this be something that might meet that test? Would you be happy to see if this could be delayed or put on hold?
Well, I think before we cut any services or programs to Californians, this should be the first thing that's put on hold. I just think that's the prudent and responsible thing to do. Most of what the governor's talking about, by the way, are gimmicks. He's talking about delaying people's paychecks for one day, 24 hours, government workers, to put it into the next budget, which would save, you know, $3 billion in this budget. So they have a lot of gimmicks and tricks they're going to use to try to paper over this budget. But the problem he has is that the Legislative Analyst Office expects that we're going to have structural deficits of about $30 billion for the next few cycles. It's not a one-time thing. So if he kicks this can down the road, he's only going to create a bigger problem for himself.
Yeah. Out of time, if people want to follow this issue, what's the best way they can follow you?
They can follow me on social media at Bill Essaily. So that's E-S-S-A-Y-L-I. And they can always visit my website at essaylyforassembly.com.
We appreciate your time with us. Keep us up to date on the story as it unfolds. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And with that, we are out of time for this week's edition of our program. We thank you for joining us, and we're glad that you tune in each week at this time. We'll be back at it again next week with another edition of our program, Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.